everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're happy to have three authors on the show, Matt Wasniewski, Kathleen Johnson, and Laura Turner O'Hara. They were part of a team that put together a wonderful book called Black Americans in Congress, 1870 to 2007. The book is very timely, obviously, because America is about to inaugurate its first black president. If you're interested in Barack Obama's predecessors, then I highly recommend you read this terrific book. It is full of lavish illustrations and accompanied by some wonderful essays by the aforementioned authors, Matt, Kathleen, and Laura. I very much enjoyed talking to them today, and I hope that you enjoy listening to the interview. Here it is. Hello, everybody.
Hi, Marshall.
I'm Marshall Poe, and this is New Books in History, and I'm happy to say today that we have Matt Wasniewski on the show, and Kathleen Johnson, and Laura Turner O'Hara, and that was in no particular order, I should say, and we'll be talking about a book that they edited and co-wrote called Black Americans in Congress, 1870 to 2007. The book is very timely, obviously, because Barack Obama, our first African-American president, is going to be inaugurated next week. Is that right? Next week?
That's right, on Tuesday.
On Tuesday, that's right. Is it cold there in Washington?
It's cold right now by Washington standards. Supposed to be highs in the teens or low 20s tomorrow.
That's not cold.
Yeah, well.
that is not cold. When I rode my bike in this morning, it was minus 23 without wind chill.
Ouch. You're a braver man than I am.
That is serious. Braver, I said just dumber. I don't know. I remember last year we were having a horrible winter, and I walked in my students, and I just said, why do we live here? What happened? There's Florida. We have Florida. You know, it's not like we can do that. But anyway, I'm hale and hearty and well. I made it in on my bike today, but I'm very excited to talk to you about this book. I wondered if we could begin, though, by asking a couple of you, that'd be Kathleen and Laura, to tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into public history. I would say that we have already asked Matt this question in a previous interview, so we're going to give him a pass. We'll send him out to get coffee for everybody.
Okay. I'll keep quiet.
Go get coffee for everybody. So, Kathleen, would you like to start, if that's okay?
Sure, that's fine. I was born in Massachusetts, and, of course, there is a lot of history in New England, so I definitely became interested in history at that point, and my parents were both teachers, so they really instilled a love of reading and learning in me, and also took my brother and I to a lot of the historic sites, especially Concord was an annual trip for us. I ended up going to college at Columbia, and I was a history major inspired by my brother, who went on to become a history professor. Mm-hmm. And when I graduated, I really wasn't sure what I was going to do. Most of my college roommates and friends went off to law school or grad school, but I decided to accept an offer to play basketball in Austria.
Yeah, that's right. I remember. That's so terrific.
Right. So when I came back, I decided to then teach in New York City, and I taught there for a few years, and I really enjoyed it. And one thing I think that awakened my interest in public history was I became involved in an after-school group that we called ourselves the New York City Explorers. Mm-hmm. And we went to museums and public history sites, and I really saw my students, even the ones that weren't previously interested in history, become fascinated with the subject. And from there, I moved to North Carolina, ended up in grad school to get a master's in education, took a few history classes, had some wonderful professors, and once again, just kind of fell into the public history path, realizing that this was something where I could do some research, study history, and also do some teaching. And then I saw the job description for the Office of History and Preservation, which combined all of my loves, and I was lucky enough to get the position.
Wow, that's great. That's a terrific story, especially as I've told you about the basketball part, because I played basketball next. I had just retired. I'm the same age as Michael Jordan, to give it away. I just like to put my name in a sentence with Michael Jordan. Tell people that. I don't know.
Well, I think you'd have to tell your listeners about the Barack Obama that you played.
Yeah, that's true. No, I did play with Barack Obama. That's true. I played with Barack Obama, and it was quite fun. It was good. I was going to tell the anecdote about how I was on the college basketball team that set the NCAA record for consecutive losses.
And what number was that?
It was a lot. It was 7 years of losses. Yeah, this is Grinnell College, and we were not, people were doing other things at Grinnell College. You know, you're a liberal arts college. It's not really big with basketball, but I loved the place. I thought it was fantastic.
Well, so, at Columbia, we were always happy if we could get a 500 season, so I do understand where you're coming from.
500 would be, that would be great. We won a game. That would be So anyway, Laura, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I was born in New Hampshire. But my dad joined the Navy when I was 3. So I lived everywhere. And from Hawaii to Bermuda and everywhere in between is usually how I describe it.
Mm-hmm.
But my dad being in the military had sort of an amateur love for military history. And I kind of caught the bug from him a little bit. For instance, when we lived in Hawaii, we would go into the hangar where his squadron was stationed, mm-hmm. and there would be bullet holes in the staircase.
Oh, yeah, right.
And the bullet holes were from the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, uh-huh. as they flew over Oahu.
Mm-hmm.
So I used to put my fingers in those holes as I used to walk up the stairs, and just found it absolutely fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we had frequent trips to Pearl Harbor and other sites in Hawaii, mm-hmm. Kind of like Kathleen having her family trips. That was sort of what we did as well. But I went into college, kind of wanted to go into journalism and social science. I was more interested in sort of the writing aspect of things.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up at Stanford University. Mm-hmm. I actually ran cross country and track there.
Wow.
So yeah, we have a kind of an office of athletes. My writing class, though, we had a required writing class my freshman year, and a very, very forward-thinking TA took us on a tour of the Hoover Institution archives.
Yeah.
As one of the sort of parts of our writing class, we had to write a big research paper, and she was showing us the archives as one of our resources, and I absolutely fell in love with the primary sources there. I don't think before that I realized that you could actually, handle some of these documents, and so I ended up doing my research paper that quarter on Japanese American interns from Stanford.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely got interested in history at that point, decided to be a history major the next year, started taking the core classes.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I'm a big fan of required classes in college because of that.
Yeah.
But I ended up writing my senior honors thesis. I ended up doing some research over the summer between my junior and senior year at the National Archives. Here in College Park, Maryland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a true.
And really fell in love with D.C. It's a town of transients, which makes it perfect for a Navy brat.
Yeah, right.
So I decided to try to come back here and pursue a public history position. It's really one of the few places I feel like where you can find a public history position straight out of college.
I think that's absolutely right. And it's a good tale for anybody who is thinking about going into history, or I would say research generally.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that D.C. is a terrific place to do that. There are just thousands and thousands of federal jobs that that one can get. I try to send my students in that direction as often mm-hmm. as possible.
Mm-hmm.
They all tend to think of going to graduate school and then becoming history professors, which actually is in many ways a more difficult career path.
Mm-hmm.
I know that when I worked in D.C., I had friends that worked in the government, and you guys actually take your holidays off, which academics don't.
Mm-hmm.
You have that nice G rating scale where you sort of get raises every once in a while. Academics don't get raises. and there are these, and the books that we have to write tend to be rather dry, and yours, obviously, in this case, are much more interesting. So, yeah, I would counsel anybody to mm-hmm. Pursue that kind of a career path. I think it's really a terrific thing, and it's an honor to have you guys on the program. There are things that you can do history outside the academy and very, very successfully. Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, no, and you and I have talked about this before, but the fact that you're actually telling your students this makes you somewhat unique, because I know mm-hmm. my program, at least in graduate school, that the first thought was to turn people out for the academy.
Yeah.
And even though University of Maryland places a lot of folks in federal government history positions,
mm-hmm.
there's not a lot of promotion. You kind of have to scratch a little bit below the surface to find it. But once you do, there's a great network of folks out there, and really would encourage any graduate students or undergraduate students to look into the possibility of doing public history.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
I started at the Center for Legislative Archives at mm-hmm. the National Archives,
mm-hmm.
and I worked there for a year, and actually was through folks at NARA and folks here that I found out about the job here. So it was definitely through the Public Historian Network that I ended up here.
And in D.C., we have a little known group, the Society for History in the Federal Government, which has a website, shfg.org. And it's the community of folks who do federal history inside the Beltway and some folks from outside the Beltway. And that's a great way to kind of see what's happening in the public history realm in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I tell my students, and I'd like your opinion on whether this is correct or not. You know, they say, I'd like to go work for X organization in Washington. And what I tell them is go work for any organization in Washington, get into the network, and then apply for jobs once you actually have a federal job, any federal job. Does that sort of make sense?
I think it does. In some places, I'll use one example: the State Department History Office, which produces the Foreign Relations series, which is a great series going back to the mid 19th century. A lot of the folks who start out there are in not what would be considered a full time federal job. They're brought on as kind of contractors, and that's an example of you come to a place, work for a while, get your foot in the door, and that opens other avenues to go to another federal history office or perhaps turn that job into a full time job.
Exactly. I actually know somebody who works at State as a historian. I also have another colleague who trained as a Russianist and Central Europeanist who then was hired by the office at the Justice Department that hunts war criminals. I'm like, how cool is that? Guy hunts Nazis. What do I do all day? I grade paper. He hunts Nazis. I grade papers. Anyway, so it's terrific. And as I say, that should be a good example for anybody who wants to go on for a career in history and in federal service. And obviously, federal service is a good thing. You know, serving your nation, that's a good thing. As Barack has told us recently. So anyway, let's talk a little bit about the book. The book is, as I said, Black Americans in Congress, 1870 to 2007. Why don't one of you tell us how this book came about?
I'll do that. It's got a long history. It goes back to 1977 when Congress authorized the publication of the first, what was then essentially a booklet about African Americans in Congress. And that was at the initiative of Congresswoman Lindy Boggs from Louisiana, who was a history teacher and a great proponent of history, and also Edward Brooke, who at the time was the Black American senator, the sole Black American senator representing Massachusetts. The book went through another edition in 1989. And then the House and Senate again passed a resolution for a third edition, which this book is. And like the Women in Congress book, we basically took the earlier editions and greatly revamped them. The profiles in the earlier editions were 250 words to 400 words, and they were just arranged alphabetically. In this book, we've taken it, we've made it chronological. So we introduce members in generations. And like the Women in Congress book, this book lays out four generations of African Americans, long generations, who come to serve in Congress. And the profiles are greatly expanded in some cases for some folks like Oscar DePriest or Adam Clayton Powell. The profiles are up to 2,500 words. And then we've set off each generation with a contextual essay that sets the scene for what's going on in Congress institutionally in both the House and the Senate, and then also what's happening in wider American society, social trends, larger political trends, and really set the scene for the experiences these people have once they come to Congress and then the experiences that are shaping Congress's priorities that are happening, on the larger American scene.
I should tell our listeners that the book is absolutely beautifully produced. It's full of wonderful illustrations and figures and charts and graphs. It measures, I don't know, I'm bad at this kind of thing, it measures, I don't know, 12 by 16, and it's quite a hefty volume. It is very suitable to put in a prominent place in your living room for people just to leaf through. It's a real work of great craftsmanship, I think.
Thank you.
What if there are more history books like it?
Thank you. I just like to throw in the two other folks from our publications department who mm-hmm. aren't on the phone now, but who helped tremendously with the book, were Aaron Ramada, who did a ton of the image research and found some mm-hmm. some fantastic images, rare images, and also took the lead on doing appendices for the book, and mm-hmm. then Terrence Rucker, who also wrote some of the latter profiles of the
mm-hmm.
book.
Mm-hmm. Let me begin. We will go through the four eras, the four generations, in just a second, but I want to begin with a more broader historiographical question, and that concerns terminology, and I'd like each of you to say a few words about this to see what you feel. The book is called Black Americans in Congress. For some of this period, the historically accurate term would have been Negro, and one might think that you would even say African Americans in Congress. How did you decide, as an editorial board, and what do you believe as individuals should be the sort of protocol for using this terminology? Actually, if I could just put you on the spot, Laura, why don't you start?
There's a portion of the introduction of the book where we talk about the terminology, and that the resolution. The print resolution authorizing the book is actually Black Americans in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of a continuity with the earlier volumes. The earlier volumes were Black Americans in Congress as well.
And that does that decision reflect the time in which it was originally commissioned?
Because they could have
probably,
said African.
I don't read minds, so
yeah,
sure why they were... why they decided to call it what it was, uh-huh. but this kept the continuity with the earlier
sure.
period.
Mm-hmm.
As well, the book also dovetails with the very influential caucus here on Capitol Hill, the Congressional Black Caucus.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone whose members, past and present through 2007, are profiled in the book.
Mm-hmm.
We also found in researching the book and talking to various scholars of black history that a position of the African-American community prefers that term, while another prefers black American. So
mm-hmm.
it actually was nice as a writer, too, to have two different words to work
yeah.
with to craft your sentences. So
exactly.
it ended up being we ended up sort of using the two words or the two phrases
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Interchangeably.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we explained that in our introduction up front.
Right, exactly.
You know? And terminology, you know, when other words were used, when Negro was used in a quote, for instance, mm-hmm. we would keep it in the quote. But the two terms that we used throughout the book in our own writing were mm-hmm. were Black American and African American.
Mm-hmm. Kathleen, do you have anything particular to add to that?
I guess, you know, pretty much echoing what Laura had said, and it wasn't as much of an issue for a lot of the members that I worked on in the 20th century. What I found going through research, for members would refer to themselves, early part of the century would be more black Americans, later part of the century would be African Americans. But we really just decided, since both terms were commonly used, that we would use them interchangeably.
Mm-hmm. 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 I see. Matt, anything?
No, they hit the highlights. I mean, you know, the print resolution for the book kind of sets the title for us,
yeah,
and
right.
so we work from there. We did go through pains to have the manuscript reviewed by African-American black scholars, and there were no red flags raised by using the terms interchangeably.
Yeah.
And again, as Laura had pointed out, we did find that there was a portion of the black community that prefers black American and another portion that prefers African American. I mean, it's one of the things that, you know, we try and get across in this book is that opinion on issues, whether it's, you know, how a group of ethnic group is termed or what their stance is on a political issue, it's never monolithic.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's one of the things that, you know, perhaps is subtly expressed in the usage of those terms throughout
mm-hmm.
the book is that there's a different opinion even within the African-American black community
mm-hmm.
About the term.
Yeah, it is a difficult problem. A professor of mine once said that you really should call people what they want to be called, but sometimes it's difficult to determine what they want to be called.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, it really is kind of a challenge in many ways. So why don't we begin talking about the four eras that you single out in the book, and I guess, Laura, you did the 19th century members, is that correct?
Yes, it did.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what makes that period. I guess it starts in 1870 and ends in 18. Remind me, I don't know. 1887.
The first one is 1887.
Yes, and it's called the symbolic generation of black Americans in Congress. What makes it the symbolic generation?
Well, the first generation of Black Americans in Congress, and in this case, we have 17 of them who served in the basically within the Reconstruction era. Mm-hmm. And they were sort of symbolic in a way that they were symbolic of the Union victory and of the radical Republicans who were the dominant force in Congress at that time, of their sort of utopian vision of that emphasized political equality of all American men, and mm-hmm. I emphasize men.
Mm-hmm.
And many of these radical Republicans were former abolitionists. They were from sort of the upper Midwest and New England. And they basically, they won the Civil War, when the Union won the Civil War, they said, okay, well, this is our chance to sort of rehabilitate the South in some ways and bring these African-American men into the fold. So they were actually always in constant friction with President Andrew Johnson, who actually believed in sort of limited federal intervention in the South. And a lot of this early era right after the Civil War and the politics is a story of their back and forth mm-hmm. between Congress and the president mm-hmm. that they tried to impeach him over. Basically, there are legislative initiatives, despite some of Johnson's opposition, they passed the Reconstruction Amendments, which these radical Republicans in Congress, which freed the slaves, granted them citizenship, and granted voting rights to all African-American men, and then created essentially the Freedmen's Bureau, which provided social services and education for them. And as well, they attempted to sort of rehabilitate the South and bring the South back into the Union, but on several conditions that had to do with bringing African Americans into full citizenship and voting rights. Mm-hmm. They divided the South into five military districts, and they required for the return to statehood new constitutional conventions on a state level, and which included enfranchising black men and the ratification of the Reconstruction Amendment mm-hmm. as qualifications to return to the Union. Mm-hmm. So these states came to the returned to the Union with these more friendly state constitutions towards these new voters, mm-hmm. as well as sort of tacitly supporting the Reconstruction Amendments, and really opened up a lot of opportunities for black voters and for black men in the South, especially those who had been previously educated or even free prior to the Civil War. Only about half of the first generation, or a little over half, were born slaves, mm-hmm. and some of them were either freed as young children or were sort of given some better opportunities within their enslavement for education and for mm-hmm. and ability to work outside of their master's home and those mm-hmm. types of opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of the setting for these people to come to Congress. And when they arrive in Congress, there's this big fanfare. This is it. This is what we were fighting for. That all men are created equal. We have black men in Congress here. In a lot of ways, they were strictly symbolic, because even though they were sort of cheered and welcomed by the radical Republicans in Congress, in a lot of ways, these black men were politically marginalized mm-hmm. throughout this early period. A lot of their legislative initiatives basically didn't make it even onto the floor, or in some cases, they rarely passed. And I think a good example of that is the attempt to reimburse depositors at the failed Freedmen Savings and Trust, otherwise known as the Freedmen's Bank. Many members put in legislation to try to reimburse those depositors who had lost all their money when the bank failed. I think it was I'm blanking on the date at this point, but 1872. And and none of those bills passed. So that's sort of an example of their legislative initiative mm-hmm. not really being seen through. But and in a lot of ways, they ended up being cheerleaders for some of the radical Republican initiatives having to do with black Americans. Mm-hmm. And they provided testimony. And we have a long section on the Civil Rights Bill in this first contextual essay, which the 1875 Civil Rights Bill, which sought equal accommodations and initially sought equal accommodations in public transportation, public accommodations, juries, schools, and these people, the black Americans in Congress ended up sort of telling their tale about, discrimination on the railroads and difficulty with their education mm-hmm. and really rallying for that cause, but really it was the white leadership that drove the passage of that the very diluted version of that bill.
What could you do? You have any favorite characters among these 17 African American legislatures? Maybe you could talk about.
There's a lot of really great characters. I really encourage people to read this portion of the book. There's some interesting people here. One of my favorites is Robert Elliott out of South Carolina. Mainly because I think he really turned a lot of the initial conventions upside down. He was very dark skinned, and a lot of these men at this era were mixed race. In fact, 17 of the 22 elected between 1870 and 1898, or who served between 1870 and 1901, were mixed race.
Mm-hmm.
So his dark skin was fairly prominent on the House floor. His mm-hmm. His three other colleagues at that point were mixed race.
Mm-hmm.
So I think people kind of looked at him and said, whoa, this is really happening.
Mm-hmm.
He also was quite the astute politician and had an amazing speaking presence.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could tell he was very well educated. He actually has kind of a colorful history, which was fun to uncover. His biographer, Peggy Lamson, only recently uncovered that he's sort of invented a lot of his own history.
Mm-hmm.
She wrote his biography in 1973, but previous to that, he'd said that he was born in Boston, that he had been educated in England at Eton College, that mm-hmm. he worked for a London barrister, and that he fought in the Civil War and was wounded, and had come up with this very nice, colorful history, which probably just made him a great candidate for political office.
Yeah, that can't
that can't be his history, because that's my history. I did all those things. No, I didn't do that.
You know, in all likelihood, he was born to West Indian parents yeah. in England, was received a public education in England, but not at Eton, and learned a typesetter's trade and ended up in a British naval warship in Boston in 1867. The historical record kind of picks him up in Charleston, working for a fellow black congressman, Richard Kane, who owned a newspaper called the Missionary Record at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a journalist, basically, for Richard Kane, and got involved in the South Carolina politics of the time in the post-Civil War era. It was really sort of an open door for black men at that point
mm-hmm.
to get involved with politics. And he became a very popular member of the state assembly and had this amazing photographic memory. His mm-hmm. law partner once sort of commented that he knew everything and everyone about politics in the state.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1870, he won the U.S. House seat for this West Central South Carolina district that included Columbia. It was a little bit farther west than most of his colleagues had districts.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the districts sort of centered around the Sea Islands and Charleston. But he and that actually incidentally was Preston Brooks's former seat,
mm-hmm.
who was a famous caning of Charles Sumner in 1856.
Yeah.
So he was actually probably a little bit more progressive than his black colleagues in his legislative initiatives. He was firmly against offering amnesty to former Confederates, and was of course this wild proponent of the Civil Rights Bill. And he actually gave a very impressive speech on the bill in January of 1874, following up on the speech given by Alexander Stevens of Georgia, who is, of course, the former Confederate vice president.
Mm-hmm.
And Stevens, who was a little bit sickly at the time and was in a wheelchair and kind of gave this sort of droning speech, was followed up by Eliot's very eloquent, very fiery speech.
Mm-hmm.
And he was quite the young man and an amazing speaker in the newspaper accounts of this time. And Eliot was a popular figure in the newspapers. Were just amazed at how well he had done and how beautifully he had spoken, and were saying, you know, we could all learn something from this man.
Mm-hmm.
Eliot, though, like a lot of South Carolinians, got very involved in state politics, and he actually resigned halfway through his second term
mm-hmm.
to return to the state legislature, and he actually served as speaker there. However, when the Democrats took over the state legislature just a few years later, Eliot found himself sort of put out of politics. He ended up trying to set up a law practice, but he, like so many of these men who have these very tragic endings, ended up dying in poverty in New Orleans from complications from an earlier malaria infection.
Yeah, I wonder, actually, I did notice that as a kind of commonality mm-hmm. among their biographies. Mm-hmm. Many of them came from nothing, and when they were done with their congressional careers, they went back to nothing.
Absolutely. And well, there's Alonzo Reince here, I think, is the most shocking example of that. He was lieutenant governor of South Carolina at one point, and he actually died in a boarding house.
Yeah.
Without a penny to his name.
Right. Yeah, so. That's a very different experience for senators and congresspeople today.
Mm-hmm.
I can. Yes, we don't need to go into that. But in any event, let's move on then to the second era, and that is the Negro's temporary farewell. It's called in the book, and we will turn to Kathleen. This was your bailiwick, is that right?
It was actually mine.
Oh, it was yours.
Sorry.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
That's fine.
Yeah, because it's a difficult thing to write about because it's the history of a kind of non-event. You know,
right.
Yeah. You know.
The title comes from itself comes from a quote by George White, who was the last African American in Congress for a very long stretch, and it comes from a floor speech in which. He was essentially promising that African Americans would return at some point, and as he put it, rise again like a phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a very long stretch, and this was a difficult portion of the book to write. It deserved its own essay, but there were so few members to write about, and that's really what the contextual essays are built around. It in this period from 1887 to all the way through 1901, when George White leaves Congress, there are only five members who serve.
Mm-hmm.
And then from 1901 to 1929, we have, you know, nearly a three-decade stretch where there's no African American in the federal legislature.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a story that, you know, so far as Congress is concerned, you know, after the formal end of Reconstruction in 1877, its attention shifts from principle to pragmatism, you know, from this dream of kind of creating a multiracial society in the South that the radical Republicans had, to a lot of the pressing issues that had to be addressed in the late 19th century, caused by the, you know, centralization of power during the Civil War, industrialization, the nation's physical growth, urban growth. And then, you know, also America's rising role in world affairs. So mm-hmm. Congress had plenty of distractions to, in many respects, eagerly turn its eye away from race issues.
Mm-hmm.
But much of the story also happens away from Capitol Hill. And that's another part of the story we wanted to tell and to get across, that, you know, change, as it so often does in American history, really doesn't come from political dictate. It comes from social movements mm-hmm. and demographic movements that are happening far away from Capitol Hill, far away from Washington, and the politicians have to respond to these things mm-hmm. ultimately. And one of the things that's happening, of course, is that once the occupying federal forces pull out of the South, the Republican governments collapse, and the former Confederates and the Democratic Party seizes control in the state governments in the South. This is a process that kind of happens over the decade of the 1880s.
Mm-hmm.
But by the 1890s, what you see going on the books is, it's not just laws, it's also through custom in the South too, which is an important thing to consider. It is that Jim Crow segregation begins to take hold.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from, you know, the poll tax, where you charge someone $2, a $2 tax to vote, or $1 tax, to the grandfather clause. If your grandfather voted before the Civil War, then you can vote now. If mm-hmm. you can't, you're disqualified. Of course, mm-hmm. that disqualifies almost every mm-hmm. African-American. White primary. All these things go on the book. State constitutions are changed, and essentially African-Americans are kind of winnowed out of the political process
mm-hmm.
in the South. And therefore, all these members who serve in the 19th century, they're Republican African-Americans elected from southern states, every last one of them, and African-American political participation in Congress just drops off a cliff.
Mm-hmm.
But there are also demographic changes that are going on here that are important for the latter eras, and the most important is the Great Migration of Black Americans away from rural districts in the South to northern urban districts.
Mm-hmm.
And this occurs because massive numbers of people are looking for employment,
mm-hmm.
which they find on the eve of World War I and then consequently throughout the 20th century in places like Chicago, St. Louis, Detroit, Cleveland, Pittsburgh. And the Great Migration has really profound consequences for black political participation in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden it shifts. It happens in the North, in urban areas, and in the era that Kathleen will talk about, it shifts party loyalty as well.
Mm-hmm.
The thing we also wanted to make clear from a congressional perspective was that institutionally this isn't a happy story either, that segregation dominated American society and Congress was a real reflection of that. You had the federal government, of course, becomes not by decree, but by practice, by custom, segregated really systematically during the Woodrow Wilson administration,
mm-hmm.
Beginning in 1913.
Mm-hmm.
And in the House itself and in the Senate, the galleries are segregated, kind of, you know, de facto segregation. You had not only a blacks gallery, but also a women's gallery, separate from the men.
Mm-hmm.
You had segregation in the House restaurant. And throughout this period, you can read what today are astounding floor speeches by Southern members who, on the rare occasions when Northern members talk about things like perhaps enforcing the 14th Amendment rights of blacks in the South or passing an anti-lynching law, deliver what could only be termed as racial screeds, yeah, on the floor, and it's an amazing thing to look at. Yet there's a few brave souls during this time period too, and that's another thing. You know, there's not any African American in Congress, but there are here and there advocates for the black community.
Mm-hmm.
And here, a couple of the folks that were mentioned in the book, a guy named Leonidas Dyer, who was a representative from Missouri, who pushed an anti-lynching law through the House with the help of the NAACP,
mm-hmm,
in the early 20s, only to have it die in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And then another fellow by the name of George Holden Tinkham of Massachusetts, who was a real character and a fun person to write about, he actually was the first American to fire a shot in World War I against the Central Powers when he was visiting the front lines, and an Italian commander of an artillery battalion convinced him to pull the firing lanyard on a cannon, mm-hmm, aimed at troops in Austria.
Mm-hmm.
He was also a guy who named his political trophies after his game trophies after political opponents. So he was a real character, and he was also one of the people who, in the 1920s, when the House is waging this battle between urban representatives and rural representatives over apportionment, you know, how seats are going to be handed out in the states, he's the guy who kind of stands up in the back and says, well, while you're talking about this, what about the 14th Amendment? What about African American rights? What about the fact that there's a clause in the 14th Amendment that says, mm-hmm, if you disenfranchise a group of qualified voters in your state, you lose that number from the total of your population figures?
Yeah.
And what he was doing in essence was to go after Southern representation in Congress.
Uh-huh.
Because if reapportionment happens with lower population totals, the Southerners are going to lose seats.
Mm-hmm.
And this too is important during this era because the South is a one party region, a solid Democratic South, beginning in the 20th century, the members, especially House members, are running in very safe districts. They accrue seniority. They move up the chain of command.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, by the 1930s, the people who are running the key power committees in the House and even in the Senate are by and large Southerners.
Mm-hmm.
Appropriations Committee, Ways and Means, Rules, any committee where anyone who wants to be a reformer, you know, would have to get their legislation through,
mm-hmm,
and And more often than not, it was a Southern segregationist in charge of the committee.
Yeah, I didn't realize that, but that makes perfect sense institutionally. Yeah, I had no idea.
So it's a difficult story to tell, but we wanted to be honest about it. Yeah. and also set the scene. In terms of African American representation, it's a long period without any.
Yeah, these are periods in which, and they're characters about which I think we should probably think pretty carefully, because in a certain strange sense, they are us. I mean, we look back on someone like Woodrow Wilson, who in this era I happen to know the most mm-hmm. about among the people that you mentioned, and he, by our standards, held ideas within his purportedly very large gray matter, which were entirely contradictory. We can't understand very easily Woodrow Wilson's mind, because on the one hand, he wants to bring peace and freedom to the, subject people of the old Austro-Hungarian Empire under the doctrine of popular sovereignty. But then he also clears out Georgetown of African Americans and moves in white people and institutes a kind of a thoroughgoing regime of segregation in the city of Washington itself.
Right.
I mean, really, how these things can be put together, I don't know. But, I imagine that you'd probably have to read Wilson's biography in order to understand how he thought that, and I firmly believe this, how he thought that was the right thing to do. I mean, these were actually, I interviewed someone a few weeks ago about the way the French treated their colonial troops. And, on the one hand, they treated them well. On the other hand, they treated them very badly. But he said it was very important to remember that they were imperialists with good consciences. They didn't think they were doing something wrong. And I think that's very important to remember with someone like Wilson or these other senators and congresspeople. They felt that this was the right thing to do. And really trying to come to grips with that is a mighty task. At least it is for me. I can't speak for you guys, but
it's complicated, and we also have to keep in mind that this is a period when, as you alluded to, this is when Darwinian notions of racial inequality were at their peak.
Yeah.
And even with some of the reformers, the few brave individuals who are kind of pushing these ideas of, well, we need an anti-lynching bill, or we need to stand up for the 14th Amendment. Even these people held contradictory ideas. On the one hand, they're pushing for protecting black rights in the South, but on the other hand, when a little bit closer to home in terms of internal change in the House, institutional change, they're a little more reticent. And you do have to. There are definitely contradictory impulses at work.
Yeah, and this is not to excuse them by any means. By our standards, obviously, it's a horrible thing that they did. But nonetheless, it is kind of an interesting exercise to try to understand them. I'm always amazed, when you read the very few things actually that Lincoln said about the black race, as he would have called it. And there are things that are surprising. you don't expect these things to come out of the great liberator's mouth, but they did, and he thought they were correct. That sort of goes to show you that. The past really is a foreign country, or even more than a foreign country. It's a foreign. It's a different planet.
Right. It has its own unique context.
And it's funny. The older I get, and as I said, I'm not young anymore. I mean, I remember things in the '60s. I was very young then, but I remember things being said that just are no longer said anymore. Mm-hmm. And they were said by people who are of great prominence and significant intelligence, and they just are no longer said anymore. It's really quite, for a historian, growing old is really an enlightening thing, I have to say. The other thing I'll say about growing old, since you guys are all youngins, is that I don't trust my memory past about a week now. Anything that happened more than a week ago, if I tell you it happened, all bets off.
I don't know, Marshall. If you're Michael Jordan's age, you're not that much older than a few of us here.
I guess that's right. All right, so let's go on then to the early 20th century, or the mid 20th century. And Kathleen, this is your provenance, right? This is your area. Am I correct?
Yes, it is.
Right. So here we have the return of African Americans. This part is called Keeping the Faith: African Americans Return to Congress. So why don't you tell us a little about that?
Sure. Well, Keeping the Faith comes from the famous catchphrase of Adam Clayton Powell, and it really the statement captures the growing momentum of black members and the increasing political activism of the civil rights movement during this era. There were 13 members during this period, and Oscar Dupree's election in 1928 ended a nearly 30-year drought. The members that were in this period were very, very diverse. And much like Reconstruction, the early part of this era, it was one black member serving at one time. So Oscar de Priest was there by himself.
Mm-hmm.
Arthur Mitchell was there by himself. Dawson for a while before Powell came in. And one thing that was quite a common theme during this period was the intense scrutiny that these members faced. They were under pressure not just to represent their constituents, but really to represent all black Americans. And this is something that we refer to in the book quite often and call it surrogate representation.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't something that members could really choose. It was thrust upon them. And in most cases, they accepted it, and they realized that this was, in some cases, a burden that they had to bear, that they had to represent all black Americans. It was particularly difficult for Oscar de Priest, who was a national symbol, and much was expected of him. But he was coming in when there had been such a drought, and he was the only black member, and he did his best. He tried to confront some of the institutional racism, for instance, with the house restaurant that Matt had talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And he was able to get the house to investigate, but inevitably their legislation wasn't passed. It was seen as a failure by blacks outside of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
But he was in a very difficult position. And then as the time period wore on, you had more members coming in, especially, of course, in the 1960s, and so at least they had allies. But before that, it was really just one black member at a time. And a big difference from the period before, from Reconstruction, was almost all of these members were Democrats,
mm-hmm.
except for Oscar de Priest and Ed Brooke. And really the switch, there are two reasons for it. One was the Great Depression, of course, and the New Deal reforms that affected so many Americans, and especially black Americans who suffered from the economic downturn and really felt that the Democratic Party had something to offer them. And so in this way, they felt that they could leave the Republicans and Hoover behind because they were going to a party that was listening to their needs.
Mm-hmm.
And then another thing, and Chicago is a great place to look at this, in the first district, especially in the South Side, is with De Priest, you had the machine politics, mm-hmm. the machine that was so entrenched there, and they really courted African-American voters, mm-hmm. and got African-Americans involved in the political system, like Oscar de Priest. And during the Great Depression and following in the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s, they started to, the Democratic Party, as they grew stronger, to follow the model by the Republicans, and they courted African-American voters and also got people like Mitchell and Dawson into the machine. And so you had this gradual switch from Republican to Democrat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was really a fun and interesting period to write about because the members were so diverse, and so much was expected of them. It was the way that they were able to withstand the pressure of having to represent, you know, not just a district, which I can imagine would just be so difficult, but to try to represent the, you know, entire black population, and especially during the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like what you said about diversity because they really are very different. I mean, somebody like Adam Clayton Powell and somebody like Ed Brooke. They come from very different backgrounds. They're
right.
Different people. Maybe you could just talk about those two a little bit.
Sure. Well, Adam Clayton Powell is, how could he not be one of your favorites when you're writing about him? He had charisma, and he demanded attention. And something that he really followed is he did not want to wait patiently while things changed within the Congress and also outside. So he came in and he let everyone know that he was going to be confrontational, and if he didn't like it, that was too bad. He didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of examples of that is some of the racism, institutional racism that these members faced, where he would have petty things that members would say, that they didn't want to have an office nearby a black member, or they didn't want to sit by a black member on the floor. And so when Powell found out about this, John Rankin, an avowed segregationist from Mississippi, he made it quite publicly known that he was not happy about Powell being there and certainly wouldn't sit near him on the floor. So Powell literally, in some cases, stalked him on the floor. And on one occasion, during one day, he made him move 5 times. So he was not going to be intimidated by anyone, and he seemed to just enjoy the challenge. And then also with the house restaurant, where De Priest tried so hard to work within the system and to get legislation passed to end the segregation,
Powell took a different approach. We referred to him as a congressional irritant, and he definitely was an irritant in many ways. He would go to the House restaurant frequently. He would bring his constituents there. He would order his staff to go there, even if they weren't going to eat. He would just tell them, if you're not hungry, just go and sit there.
Uh-huh.
You know, he was making a very public stand. He was making people uncomfortable. That was his approach.
Yeah.
Ed Brooke came from a much different background than that. He was a Republican. He was coming from Massachusetts. He also was coming into the Senate, the first senator of the century, the first black senator of the century. He was much more mainstream, but he also talked about being welcomed in the Senate and having a different experience than Powell,
mm-hmm.
and that the senators really didn't treat him any differently.
Yeah.
And that there wasn't... he just had a very different experience. And then you also have to understand, too, that Powell is coming from Harlem, and his constituents
yeah.
loved his confrontational approach.
Yeah.
And with Brooke, he's representing Massachusetts, which,
yeah.
of course, was liberal at the time, but he had a very different group of people to answer to. And
yeah.
so he had a different approach altogether.
Yeah. No, I find the two of them, the contrast between the two of them, very, very interesting. And I suppose if you exaggerate it a little bit, you know, you can see in the two of them, on the one hand, the, you know, the accommodationist attempt to win power on Brooke's side, and then on the other hand, the confrontationalist approach on Adam Clayton Powell's. And these approaches, until I don't know if they're still with us, but they certainly in my life have been with us. You know, I don't know if it's right to mention these people, but someone like Alan Keyes, you know, is quite an establishment figure. But then on the other hand, you know, you have your Jesse Jacksons and Jesse Jackson Jr. who are really much more confrontational in their approach. And these two approaches, I think, go back. I'm not an African-American historian, but I think they go way back.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really know anything about Brooke until I read the book, but I found it absolutely fascinating.
If I can just interject about yeah. Brooke, he had a very enlightening anecdote that he told in his memoirs recently, which Kathleen included in the profile, and it's it gets to the way the Senate operates versus the House,
mm-hmm.
in addition to, you know, kind of race issues, broader race issues. He remembered going down to the Senate swimming pool at one point and walked in, and in the pool is Strom Thurmond and two other segregationist senators, and he totally expected to just be snubbed. But the three of them each warmly invited him
yeah.
into the pool and said, "You make use of these facilities, you know, to the, you know, the best of your, you know, your every woman desire. You know, please use
yeah.
facilities."
Yeah.
And he said it that probably bothered him more than it would have if they had just snubbed him, because
yeah.
these were the same people who were getting out on the floor and supporting legislation that obviously didn't have African Americans, you know, they didn't have African Americans in the best interest.
Yeah.
And that gets a little bit to the way the Senate operates, you know, the chummy, clubby atmosphere of the Senate.
Uh-huh.
And it's, you know, genteel traditions of, you know, to go along, get along. And where the House, you know, a little bit more hangs out in public view.
And another point I think is important to stress is that you didn't always have these opposite extremes. It wasn't that you had someone that was
mm-hmm.
so confrontational or someone that was going to be an institutional player. You had someone like Charlie Dix from Detroit,
mm-hmm.
who served starting in 1955 and through 1980, and he really tried to adopt both approaches. He
mm-hmm.
would be confrontational and outspoken when he needed to be, and he also was he had a good, solid institutional knowledge. He
mm-hmm.
was on the Foreign Affairs Committee. He chaired the D.C. Committee. He was the first chair of the CBC, so he was really able to play both sides, and he used it effectively. He was able to get legislation passed, and he was able to satisfy his constituents. So you did have some people that were very, very politically astute and felt comfortable playing
mm-hmm.
both of those roles
mm-hmm.
and did it quite well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We should also mention, since this sheds a little bit of light on Barack Obama, the significant role that Illinois and Chicago particularly played in this era and the next era in moving black Americans into the House of Representatives and the Senate. Maybe somebody could just say a few words about that.
Yes, sir. I'll take that. well, the first district is of Chicago is one that we highlighted in the contextual essay, and then it's also going to be something that people can read about in the individual profiles in DePriest and Dawson, Mitchell, Metcalf. It's the black representation there has been throughout the 20th century.
Uh-huh.
And really, and this is something that I touched upon briefly, the importance of this and the increased opportunities were due to the machine politics that started with the Republican machine bosses that realized the potential of blacks within their district or within the city of Chicago,
mm-hmm.
and were able to not just to encourage them to become involved in the machine, but to become political players and mm-hmm. gave them that important experience. And then the Democrats took on this approach, realizing how effective it was. And so it was a chance for African Americans that had never had a chance to become involved in politics mm-hmm. to suddenly have the highest field that they could go to Congress or, mm-hmm. or have a chance to be really important players within Chicago. And then you'll see this model followed in other northern cities as well, like Detroit and Pittsburgh and New York.
There's a good book, The First District there in Chicago. Has anyone written that book? Just about the district?
Not just about the district. We certainly found some secondary sources that covered that, but not just on that particular one. And you're right. I mean, the history there is incredibly rich.
Maybe you should start a graduate program. Take on a graduate student. I'm right there for you.
That's a good idea.
Or, a fellowship program. You could have mm-hmm. a congressional fellowship. You could help them out. Since you guys know where all the archives are and everything else, and you have access to these people, I mean, actually, that would be a wonderful thing. If anyone is listening, give these people money to start a fellowship program for graduate study in Washington.
Thanks, Marshall.
Barack, if you're there, now you send these people a check, okay? None of that funny stimulus package money either. I want hard currency. So let's talk a little bit about the last year, and that is called Permanent Interest, the Expansion and Organization and Rising Influence of African Americans in Congress. And at this point, really, the number of African Americans balloons. Who'd like to take that on?
I'll start, but Kathleen and Laura can certainly jump in because we all had a hand in this one. This time period runs from 1970 on up, and as you point out, the numbers statistically go through the roof. 70% of all the African Americans who've served in Congress were elected in 1970 or later, and there have been if and when Mr. Burris is seated, looks like he will be now. The senator from Illinois, then we're up to, I believe, about 125 mm-hmm. throughout congressional history.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a sense of the numbers there. And a lot of that has to do with, the civil rights movement having come to fruition, particularly the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Particularly from southern districts, but also because of redistricting in northern urban districts, you see a leap in the number of House members who are elected. You see, for the first time since Reconstruction, Black Americans elected from the South. Andrew Young from a district in Atlanta, and Barbara Jordan from a district in Houston. And so you see change beginning to happen in that sense. When you get more numbers in, that allows you to organize, and that had been one of the goals very early on for Charlie Diggs, who Kathleen had mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to create a caucus of African American members, and in 1971, he had an informal caucus for one Congress before that. But in 1971, the Congressional Black Caucus is founded,
mm-hmm.
and that has profound repercussions both internally and externally, legislatively, for Black Americans.
Mm-hmm.
I'll speak to one of them, and then I'll turn it over to Kathleen because she worked with the Congressional Black Caucus materials quite a bit. One of the things that happens inside the House is that with the Congressional Black Caucus, now you have an advocacy group who can go to the leadership and lobby for members to get put on powerful committees.
Mm-hmm.
So it's during this period that for the first time we have African-American members on committees like Appropriations and the Ways and Means Committee,
mm-hmm.
and the Armed Services Committee.
Mm-hmm.
And this is largely because the Black Caucus has gone to the Speaker and the Majority Leader and said, look, we need representation across the full spectrum of committees here.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of this period, I'll leap ahead, you see what in a lot of ways is kind of an ironic reversal, because during the Civil Rights era in the House, Southerners controlled committee chairmanships and the key power points.
Mm-hmm.
by the 110th Congress, 111th Congress, which we've just entered, African Americans hold very important positions throughout the House. A couple hold full committee chairmanships, mm-hmm. Charlie Rangel on Ways and Means and John Conyers on Judiciary, to name mm-hmm. two. But what's interesting is if you look one layer below that at the subcommittees, in the 110th Congress, there were it varied over time because we lost a few African-American members, but 42, 43 members in the House, half of them held subcommittee chairmanships. And subcommittee chairmanships are kind of the traditional route mm-hmm. to greater positions of power. And so you see a reversal from the civil rights era. A lot of that has to do with the CBC's work to get recognition for these members and get them onto to more powerful assignments and committees.
Mm-hmm.
And Kathleen can address some of the legislative issues.
Kathleen.
Well, and I just wanted to follow up with what Matt said, and he mentioned armed services, and there's a really good story about Ron Dellums at this point. The CBC was gaining power, and they were doing it quite quickly, which was impressive because this was going to be in the early 70s, and they were just formed in 1971. And they put together a very concerted effort to get Ron Dellums, who wanted to be on armed services. Now, Ron Dellums came from Berkeley, and he had run on an anti-war platform, and he made his feelings on Vietnam quite clear. And Edward Hebert of Louisiana was the chairman, and he did not want Dellums on his committee. No way, no how. Yeah. And at the same time, he also had to deal with Pat Schroeder, who wanted to be on the committee. So this is Hebert who has to deal with an African-American and a woman who both want to be on his committee. So you can understand how he's feeling about that. So the CBC was able to successfully draft a letter and put pressure on Speaker Adler at the time and get Dellums on the committee.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Hebert, and this is another story that Schroeder likes to tell, was so upset with the fact that his power, you know, that he was supposed to be able to decide who was on his committee, and he was forced to take a woman and an African-American, that he allegedly made the two of them share one chair during the first committee meeting. And this is something that Dellums has also supported. So even though change was happening, it certainly wasn't happening with open arms in some cases.
No, it really sounds like that.
And the CBC, too, it was very impressive because they had small numbers in the beginning, and yet early on, just when they first started, they were able to make headlines, to get the press. And for example, in 1971, right after they formed, or right when they were in the process of forming, they boycotted Nixon's State of the Union address in protest for him not listening to African Americans' issues and supporting civil rights in their opinion. And 2 months later, they were able to get a face-to-face meeting with him, which is unprecedented. And this is just a very good example of how being able to form in a group and to have a unified front, how they were able to become a substantial bloc.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And another thing relating to the CBC and also this period, which is very, very important, was the movement against apartheid. This was something that united and in some ways defined black members during this period. It was a movement that started in the late 60s by Charlie Diggs again, and then it was picked up by Ron Dellums and other members. Ron Dellums was the first member to call for economic sanctions against South Africa. And the CBC was very much involved in the high-profile movement that carried on into the 1970s and the 1980s in a lot of the sit-ins and the eventual arrests of people at the South African embassy.
Mm-hmm.
So you see some of these high-profile things going on outside of Congress, and then you see institutional work that they're doing, understanding how change can be made within the system. So all of a sudden you have such a huge change from just the early part of the century where there were one, two, three, four members, and now all of a sudden you have even when it's just in the teens, that they're able to unify and people have to take their concerns seriously.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, it's interesting. And now the Congressional Black Caucus is a big deal, I guess. Yeah, I mean, I hate to say it, but we're almost out of time. And I want to close by asking two questions. The first one is our traditional question, and then the last one is a surprise. And the traditional question is, what is next for you guys? What are you guys working on now?
Well, we're enjoying a time when we're not drafting essays for a book that's on a tight deadline.
Right.
We're working on some projects. We have an oral history program which Kathleen manages,
And we're looking forward to doing some interviews in the next year. We focus on longtime staff members, people who either kind of work behind the scenes on committees or from member offices, or support folks. And we have a number of interviews lined up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an interesting way for us to learn the nuts and bolts of institutional history. And we're looking forward in the not-too-distant future to put all that material up on the web.
Mm-hmm.
And we're also we handle a number of reference questions. That's kind of our bread and butter.
Uh-huh.
From day to day.
You have Hispanic Americans in Congress.
Oh yeah, we do. Yeah. We do. We have two more books in the series coming up, and Hispanic Americans and Asian Pacific Americans.
Yeah.
And those stories are going to be quite different. Both, you know, unlike these women in Congress and Black Americans in Congress, there'll be stories that'll be driven by foreign policy and U.S. expansion.
Uh-huh.
And for Hispanic Americans, the story extends all the way back to the 1820s, because our first Hispanic American is a delegate from Florida who was a Jacksonian slave owner and Indian hunter. So it's quite a story to tell. And then our story of Asian Pacific Americans really starts in the 20th century. The first Asian Pacific American is a fellow by the name of Dalip Sand from the Imperial Valley in California, who was elected in the mid-1950s. So that too is a much different story to tell.
God love the United States. Those stories.
I'm also going to interject with a shameless plug. We're always we just got done with a lot of our updates to our website for the 111th Congress. Uh-huh. And our website is sort of a jewel of information.
Yeah,
I think people are surprised sometimes when they call us and we say, oh, we have that on the web.
Yeah.
So it's at clerk.house.gov, no www, and it's the Art and History tab.
Yeah.
And we should also mention that there is an accompanying website for the Black Americans book, which has all the material up and some additional material, which Kathleen can speak to very quickly here.
We have some educational activities for teachers, mainly aimed at high school teachers, mm-hmm. and we also have a section for any teachers, middle school, high school, and college professors who want a copy of the book. They can go to our website, so mm-hmm. Women in Congress and also Black Americans in Congress, and if they just fill out a very simple form and send it to us, tell us how they're going to use it in their classes, we'll send you a complimentary copy of the book.
Well, that's terrific. It's very nice of you. Well, I hope a lot of people
buy
the book. Okay, here's the final question, and I want you guys to be brief here. What are you going to do on Inauguration Day? What happens on Inauguration Day for you guys?
And battening down the hatches and staying home.
We were going to come ask you for tickets.
Yeah,
played one-on-one against Obama.
I beat a Barack, so I don't think he sent me any tickets. He doesn't like to remember that. No, I says. Well, anyway, I just want to thank you guys for being on the show. In the interest of full disclosure, I should tell our listeners that there was a little mistake made by yours truly, and that we had to do this again. But I think it turned out fantastically. And, again, when these other two books come out, and if you have any other projects you want to talk to me about, please give me a call, and we'll do more interviews, hopefully just one at a time this time, okay?
We'd love to, Marshall. Thank you for your help.
All right, absolutely. Thanks very much for being on the show.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to an interview with Matt Wasniewski, Kathleen Johnson, and Laura Turner O'Hara about their new book, Black Americans in Congress, 1870 to 2007. I'm Marshall Pope, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.